Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. Nicholas Montalto joins us today to respond to your questions and comments on gynecology and gynecologic surgery. He comes to us from Ellis Medical Group, where he specializes in robotics-assisted minimally invasive surgery, including single-incision hysterectomy, fibroid removal, and tubal reversal. Dr. Montalto earned his medical degree from St. George's University School of Medicine and completed his residency at SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse. He's board certified by the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology and is the medical director of Ellis Medical Group's Robotic Surgery Division. He's one of only a handful of surgeons in the nation to offer robotic-assisted single-incision hysterectomies. Dr. Montalto, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So let me start you off. And by the way, these phones will all be. And don't be yelling at me out there if in fact you don't get in at the end of the show, because now that's the time. There are five free phones right this second. I guess the first thing I want to know is let's get a certain vocabulary together. What is robotic surgery?
So robotic surgery is a method of doing minimally invasive surgery. It's using a camera that is typically inserted through the belly button. And robotics allows you to see in three dimensions because it has two lenses that you can see through.
Wow.
And the instruments, unlike traditional laparoscopic instruments, which were rigid, these actually move. They have a pulley system. And the instrument will actually move in the same directions as the human hand will move. The surgeon, instead of standing at the bedside, as in traditional laparoscopy, is actually seated at a video console where I look through a monitor that sees into the body, and then I manipulate the instruments, the micro instruments that are inside the body.
I've always had this theory that if you played Nintendo as a kid, you're better at this than if you weren't.
And I never did. Yeah, I never had an interest. But it is a fairly the company that produces the robot, makes the robot, is called Intuitive, and it actually is intuitive.
Are we going more and more in that direction for surgeons?
I think so. You know, I think as technology advances, we want to be able to see better, and that's what this enables us to do. To see in three dimensions, unlike looking at a television screen, is better. And then manipulating the instruments more like you can move your own human hand makes the surgery more effective.
And also infection rates go down when you use robotics, don't you?
That's been an advantage of minimally invasive surgery. So as we get away from large incisions in the abdomen, the infection rate has gone down dramatically.
Wow. Okay. So now let's talk about some of the operations you do. For those of us who are not real familiar with this, a hysterectomy is?
So a hysterectomy is removing a woman's uterus from the body. And that typically includes the cervix, which is part of the uterus as well. And that can be with or without removing the ovaries, depending on a woman's age.
Okay, let's have some definition on all of those. The uterus is there to have babies with, is that right?
Yes, the uterus is a pelvic organ. It's where a woman menstruates every month, and its ultimate function is to house the baby.
Uh-huh. And the ovaries?
The ovaries are hormonal organs, so primarily they release estrogen and progesterone, which is what regulates the woman's menstrual cycle every month.
Okay, and why would somebody have a hysterectomy?
So the major reason for having a hysterectomy is usually what they call abnormal uterine bleeding. So the woman's uterus bleeds either too often during the month or too heavily during the month, and that impacts her ability to sort of do her normal functioning.
And which are the places that women can get cancers?
So like men, you can get cancer anywhere in the body, but
sure.
But the more specifically for a woman, you can have cancer of the uterus, cancer of the cervix, cancer of the ovaries.
And which are generally considered to be, if you want to, nobody wants cancer, but which are the most serious of those?
And it's funny, that's what I actually tell women. You don't want cancer, but if you're going to get cancer of the uterus is probably the easiest one to treat.
Really?
Yes, and that's because it typically occurs when women are postmenopausal, so they no longer are menstruating. And it's easy to diagnose because they have abnormal bleeding, so it's easy to find. Ovarian cancer is the toughest. Ovarian cancer usually presents in stage 3. In fact, 75% of them do. And they're very small organs deep in the pelvis, and it's very difficult to discover those cancers.
Are we making any progress?
We're trying. We're looking for more nonspecific symptoms, but there still is not a good cancer marker for ovarian cancer.
And what is usually the, I'm sorry to put it this way, but the the time between diagnosis and stage three and the end?
The time from the time to sort of onset of cancer to diagnosis can be years and years because the ovaries are small and deep in the pelvis. But from the time of diagnosis and then surgery, chemotherapy, and potentially radiation, it can be months to years. But I think the cure rates are getting, or sort of the 10-year survival and 5-year survival rates are getting much better for ovarian cancer.
That's good. I knew somebody who lasted 10 years and mm-hmm. was really quite a dramatic story.
Yeah.
If you had to give advice to women who are listening to this program right now about what they should be doing to preserve their, for want of a better word, gynecological health, what would you say?
You know, I think, like a lot of things, routine medical care is probably the best thing that they can do. 60% of primary care physicians actually do most women's health. So either following up with your OBGYN for routine care or for with your primary care physician for routine care is the way to go. So pap smears occasionally, and those guidelines have changed, be done. We used to do a lot more pap smears than we do now. Now that we know what causes cervical cancer and precancerous changes, which is the human
HPV.
Papillomavirus, right, exactly, we don't need as many pap smears as we thought we did. And knowing a woman's HPV status, which most OBGYNs and primary care physicians look into when they have a pap smear, is going to be helpful.
Now, we are recommending that young girls, as well as young men now,
yes.
get the antiviral injection,
right?
The
HPV vaccine, right.
Vaccine. Is it too early, or are we seeing any improvement at all here?
I think it's too early to see, to sort of see what kind of improvement ultimately we have. But it is sort of makes sense that it's going to be beneficial. If you can prevent the onset of the virus, you're going to decrease incidences of cervical cancer.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You know, every once in a while, somebody will write me or call me and say, that because of a question that they asked on the air and they were having trouble asking, you know, you're going to be anonymous out there, and say, you know, I think it saved my life. I'd love to hear from you today, and it can be a man or a woman or anybody who is basically acting in behalf of somebody else who may have a problem. 1-800-348-2551. Tell me about fibroids. What are they?
So fibroid tumors are benign tumors made up of the same substance of the uterus, which is muscle, and they are encapsulated within the uterine body, and they can grow to be very large, the size of a basketball, or they can grow in places that give women abnormal bleeding problems, which is typically inside the uterus.
But they're not necessarily caused by cancers.
No, they are not cancer. There can be transformation of a fibroid into a tumor, but that's incredibly rare.
Wow. And when you take something laparoscopically, the size of a basketball, out of somebody's body, how do you do that with a little tiny incision?
So it's interesting. So the incisions that we use are about the width of the thumbnail, let's say. And there's an instrument or a tube that can be inserted through that incision, which actually has a rotating blade on the end of it. And you actually pull the fibroid into the blade. And it is analogous to taking the skin off the outside of an apple.
Oof.
So the fibroid rolls and comes out in strips. We can remove the uterus that way also.
How'd you learn to do that?
I was trained.
Okay. We've got a Renee in Saratoga. Okay, Renee, you're on.
Fibroid rolls out in strips.
Hey, Renee.
Yes, hello.
Okay, you're on. Turn down your radio, please.
And I turned it off.
Okay, go ahead, Renee.
My question is, since there's ovarian cancer in my family, would a hysterectomy be recommended?
No. So, depending on how much cancer there is in somebody's family, sort of determines how much follow-up you should have with your OBGYN or with your primary care physician. But the uterus and the ovaries in that respect are pretty unrelated. There are not great screening tests out for ovarian cancer, although they're the best one that they have is following a tumor marker and ultrasound, but that's never been shown to be very promising. So I think the best thing that you can do is keep sort of kind of close surveillance with your OBGYN or your primary care physician, knowing that you have an increased risk in the family.
So when you say ovarian comes out usually at stage three, Are you telling us that really we don't know yet how to diagnose it 1 and 2?
Right. So what we...
What would symptoms be?
So the symptoms typically are... what we're starting to look at are sort of some grayer symptoms, and that is changes in appetite, changes in sort of the way clothes fit, whether or not you feel some more bloating than you had before, being full earlier when you eat meals. Now, these are all, you can imagine, very nonspecific, and a lot of things could lead to those, including indigestion. So they're not great ways of telling whether or not there's a cancer there. But what we're starting to look at, though, is more of those sort of constitutional symptoms. That may lead your provider to, let's say, do an ultrasound and see if the ovaries look normal or abnormal. The problem is, oftentimes the ovaries will look abnormal with things that are not cancer, and sometimes they can look normal even though there's a tiny microscopic cancer that's growing. So, you know, depending on how strong a family history of ovarian cancer you have, sort of determines what your provider might do. There is genetic testing if there are multiple relatives, especially sort of a mother, a sister, a mother, grandmother that have ovarian cancer. They may be more likely to do ultrasounds periodically and look at tumor markers. And there is even consideration of removing ovaries in women that are positive for that genetic form of cancer.
But we have identified the gene.
The most well-known gene is the BRCA gene, the BRCA gene, which is a breast ovarian cancer gene. If you're positive for that gene, then there's a 50% lifetime risk of ovarian cancer and an 80% lifetime risk of breast cancer.
Wow. Hey, Renee, I'm so sorry. We have to let you go because we have to take a little break here.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Okay. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Mount St. Mary College, Newburgh, offering registered nurses the RN to Bachelor of Science degree in nursing through an online program. Info session on January 9th from 2 to 7 p.m. MSMC.edu. Marriott Town Place Suites, Albany Downtown, offering studio, 1- and 2-bedroom suites with fully equipped kitchens. Amenities include indoor pool, breakfast, local transportation, Wi-Fi, and parking. TPSAlbany.com for reservations. Anderson Center for Autism, Statsburg, New York, working to improve lives on the spectrum from 18 months to adulthood, diagnosis to graduation, andersoncares.org. And Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees, offering daily specials, 518-432-0358.
Hello and welcome once again to our discussion with Dr. Nicholas Montalto, and he's talking about gynecology, but also he's in charge of all the stuff at over there in Schenectady for those people who are doing robotic surgery in other areas too. You're director of robotic surgery, aren't you?
Yes, I am. So we started our robotic surgery program in December of 2011.
Yeah.
And we are actually, Ellis Hospital Ellis Medicine is actually one of the fastest growing robotic programs in the Northeast. We do thoracic surgery, which is operating within the chest, and that's traditionally been a field where you had large open incisions and a long, painful, typically, recovery. And so now what we're able to do sometimes is to remove things like tumors from the lung, tumors from the chest cavity, through tiny incisions utilizing robotics.
Wow. Okay, so we're going to take some more calls. Let's go to Shauna in Cornwall, New York. Okay, is it Shauna?
Yes, it is.
Okay, Shauna, you ask your question.
Okay, great. Just a quick question, and that is, for women who have unopposed estrogen issues, I myself have recently dealt with that, and it resulted in a hysterectomy in November. Are there any things that one can do lifestyle-wise or dietary-wise or supplement-wise to sort of deal with that?
So your hysterectomy was for unopposed estrogen, and so that's sort of taking care of that problem by removing the uterus? Is that what I'm...
Well, yeah, sorry. So the history is I'm 48. I had a hysterectomy in November. I had hyperplasia with atypia, in the surgical staging, no cancer was found, and I had made the decision to keep my ovaries. And upon final pathology, there was no cancer. But I'm, you know, still thinking about the fact that there's this unopposed estrogen, and might it, you know, surface in some other way at some other point, and wondering if there's a way to sort of deal with that post hysterectomy, where the ovaries were preserved.
Right. No. So I think that it sounds like a great story. Actually, you know, endometrial, you know, complex hyperplasia with atypia has a 30% chance of having an underlying uterine cancer. So you did the right thing in getting the hysterectomy. But as you said, you don't have cancer. So one of the things that I guess women have to be sort of cognizant of is that the cause of endometrial cancer is this unopposed estrogen or too much estrogen. But it is not the cause of ovarian cancer. So it's good that you kept your ovaries because you need those for your heart, as well as not getting hot flashes and night sweats, right? But I don't think that you need to worry about anything else. The other place that estrogen or unopposed estrogen is important is the breast, of course. Because some breast cancers can be estrogen receptor positive, they say. But there really has not been any studies to show that if you take sort of the anti-estrogen, which is progesterone, that's going to help you at all. I think that you're fine, and I wouldn't worry about modifying your diet or anything.
There's a major debate, this business of estrogen and anti-estrogen.
It's very debate, you're right. And there's a lot of talk now about the, you know, sort of the hormones used in our food and things like that that may be giving us all too much estrogen. But
just for our listeners who may not be familiar with it, doctor, could you tell us about endometrial, what that means?
Yes. So the endometrium is essentially the lining that grows within the uterus. So over the course of a woman's cycle every month, estrogen that comes from her ovaries builds up her endometrial lining, or the lining inside the uterus, and then typically she ovulates, or she releases an egg, and then there's progesterone, which is sort of that anti-estrogen. And if she doesn't get pregnant at the end of the month, when the progesterone level drops, she'll get a period. Uh-huh. That's sort of the monthly life cycle of the uterus.
Well, Shauna, anything else real quick?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much. Okay.
Bye-bye.
That leaves lots of free phones. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Ask a question now, because at the end, you'll be too late. Let's go to Juliana. Juliana, you're on.
Hi.
Hey.
I am curious. I know that I have fibroids. I don't think that they're growing. I know I need to have an ultrasound. I am 51 and have experienced my first skipping of a period for 2 months. And then I had a very light period. And then another month later, I had an incredibly heavy period. So I'm just wondering if that's all kind of normal, or if I should worry about my fibroids.
No, so you should not worry about your fibroids. And you will probably transition into menopause without any issues from your fibroids. What happens as you get to this sort of stage in your reproductive life is that you've run out of eggs, right? So when we talked about the monthly cycle, where the first half of the cycle, it's estrogen building up and then releasing an egg and then progesterone, you're probably not doing that often anymore. And so it's just estrogen all the time without the progesterone from the egg being released. And so what happens is you'll have a couple of months of a light period, but now so much lining has built up from all the estrogen that you'll get a very, very heavy period. But what's going to happen as you completely run out of eggs is that the estrogen level will decline also, and so you won't build up a lining inside the uterus and your periods will stop altogether. So if you're okay with the way things are going, and I know it's unpredictable and that can be challenging, it will all resolve itself. And the fibroids actually are need estrogen in order to grow. So some women in this transition time in their life, their fibroids will get a little bit larger, but typically as your estrogen level decreases, so will the fibroids, and they should probably never be a problem for you.
Wonderful. Now, is there something, I know when I was pregnant, I took evening primrose oil. It seemed to really help kind of regulate my hormonal balance. Is that something that might be helpful for me now?
Never that a study's shown. Women will try to do some things that may sort of increase their progesterone level or decrease their estrogen level, but never anything that's sort of been definitively shown. So I think if it works for you, I think the side effects from evening primrose oil are minimal. So if it seems like it works, I'd continue it.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Julian. Okay. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, one free phone. Let's go to Joseph in Rotterdam. Okay, Joseph, welcome to the show.
Hi, doctor. I got a question. My wife was recently had vaginal infection, and the doctor prescribed Flagyl. He didn't say what the infection was, what kind of bacteria, what it was caused from, or if the partner should be treated. So I wanted to know your opinion about that.
So the infection that's being treated is something called bacterial vaginosis, which is a bacteria, and the name of the bacteria is Gardnerella. And it is normally in every woman's vagina, but is kept at a very low level because of the pH of the vagina. And so if the pH of the vagina goes up, so it becomes more basic rather than acidic, then the Gardnerella, which is the bacterial vaginosis, grows at a higher numbers and can give women symptoms. And the typical symptoms are discharge. And so it's basically treated with the Flagyl, and the Flagyl will decrease the bacteria number. But the real goal is that the vaginal pH needs to become acidic again, and her provider can help her with that.
Now, what about his question about
I don't think that you need to be treated. There can be bacterial vaginosis or Gardnerella within the urethra of the male, and some people do talk about transmitting infection back and forth, but that's uncommon.
Yeah, what's the reaction to Flagyl? Is it a drug that people react to?
Side effect wise, it can be pretty harsh on the GI tract or the stomach, so it can make some people nauseous.
Sorry, Joseph, go ahead.
She's 52 and not menopausal yet. Could that play a factor into this?
No, it shouldn't. Although as a woman ages and her estrogen level changes, so can the pH of the vagina. So, but it's not typical to get an increasing number of infections as she transitions to menopause, which she should be doing relatively soon.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Joseph. Appreciate your call. All right, let's go to Donna in Clifton Park. Donna, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Montalto. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the differences between doing a surgery with the robot versus doing it like abdominally or otherwise. And is there a pro or con? Because I thought there was like a little bit of controversy recently over the different kinds of surgeries. And I wondered, you know, if you could talk about that.
So I think the big advantage or sort of historically the big change was from laparoscopic to laparoscopic surgery from abdominal surgery. So taking a big incision in a woman or anyone's abdomen that could either be vertical going right around the belly button or from hip to hip and transitioning to small incisions, which is laparoscopic surgery. That dramatically decreased many things, the infection rate that women or men would get post-surgically, and the time to sort of getting back to your normal activities, including family life and work. For example, an abdominal hysterectomy, which would have a 6 to 8 week recovery with laparoscopic surgery, and now with robotic surgery, can be more like a 2 week recovery. And I've had some patients that have been back to work inside of a week in 3 or 4 days due to the small incisions that they have. And I'd say sort of the decreased infection rate, quick return to normal activities, as well as decreased blood loss are the three big advantages.
Now, is there a disadvantage? Any disadvantage which the literature or anybody else has been identifying?
Now, the literature is really clear in only the advantages of laparoscopic or minimally invasive over open. There is less literature suggesting that robotic is any different than laparoscopic. There is a difference between robotic and laparoscopic, and what is that?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'd say the big difference is that laparoscopic surgery, laparoscopic hysterectomy, fibroid removal is a very difficult surgery to perform. Robotics makes that dramatically easier. So there are a lot of surgeons now that are able to offer women minimally invasive hysterectomies and fibroid removal that otherwise would have gotten open surgeries because they just didn't have the training to do it laparoscopic or the time to get trained.
Okay, so that raises an interesting question. What about all those guys, the doctors or women or men, who don't do it? Do they have to retrain? How does that work?
So there's It's actually a very interesting question. And there was an association, it's called the American Association of Gynecologic Laparoscopists, who put out a position statement several years ago that said standard of care should be a laparoscopic or a vaginal hysterectomy, not an open one. And if you can't do it either vaginally or laparoscopically, you should either refer the patient, learn the skill. And so what a lot of doctors have done, if they've taken to robotics in order to sort of have a faster learning curve to offering the minimally invasive surgery.
Interesting. Well, is it Amy?
Donna.
Oh, Donna. Donna.
Oh, Donna,
I'm so
sorry. Thank you very much for your call. It was you got a great answer. I appreciate it. Yeah. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. So, Pauline, what we want to do is keep the one I'm talking to over in the beginning, okay? Thank you, dear. 1-800-348-2551. So, I believe that's right. So, that's Jerry in Kinderhook. Okay, Jerry, you're on.
Yes, hi, doctor. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question regarding ovarian cancer.
Okay.
We seem to have a theme going here. My mother had ovarian cancer, and so my sister proactively went in to have her ovaries removed. And the doctor told her after the surgery that they were striated, and he was unable to remove them. So I wondered, is this a common thing, striated ovaries? And would that not have showed up during an ultrasound?
So I think there must be a different word. Striated, I've never heard of.
She's down south.
Yeah, okay. So I'm not exactly sure what that means. All I can think of is that if they went in to remove the ovaries and the ovaries were very adhesed or stuck into the pelvis, then they could have been very difficult to remove, and that might have been the reason.
That was the situation.
That's what I would think. And
we call that adhesion, right?
Adhesions, yes, yeah. Are essentially just things sticking to other things, and typically the ovaries can stick very deep into the pelvis, and really against some pretty vital structures like the intestines and the bladder, so they could be very difficult to remove. And there's a condition there's a condition also called endometriosis, which can cause those adhesions.
Oh, endometriosis, the migrating of this causes the...
It's exactly that. It's the migration of that endometrial tissue outside of the uterus into the pelvis.
Interesting. Jerry, anything else?
Yeah. Well, I just wondered, would that not have showed up in a pelvic ultrasound?
No, it actually won't. So when yes, the easiest way to determine whether or not that may be the case is if a woman has had multiple prior surgeries, or gives a good history of painful menstrual cycles, which can indicate endometriosis.
Okay.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the call.
You're welcome.
It's interesting, this adhesion stuff. Every once in a while you start hearing about it. I think one of our former governors had adhesion and had to be moved from the local hospital to Columbia Presbyterian because they found it in his body.
Yeah, abdominal adhesions are probably most common.
Yeah.
So the intestines are very tricky to get unstuck once they're stuck.
Yeah. Oof. Okay, let's go to Amy in Albany. Okay, Amy, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just curious if there's any reliable research that has looked at linking or that there's no link between fertility treatments and the incidence of ovarian or uterine cancer.
There's not. So it is something that's, of course, infertility treatments have become, much more common nowadays as women have sort of delayed childbearing. But no study, to my knowledge, has really shown an increase in the rate of ovarian cancer as a result of fertility medications. And that goes the same for all contraceptives. They continually look at that to see if there's an increase in ovarian cancer as well. And it turns out there's actually a decrease in ovarian cancer from using oral contraceptives. But in terms of fertility treatments, there is not an increase.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amy. Now, there are women who, for want of a better term, I probably am being insensitive here, have their tubes tied. And once they do that, can you reverse that?
Yeah, so one of the surgeries that I do perform is fallopian tube reversal. So often the scenario is that women have had a couple of kids or one child, and they think that they're done, and so they get their tubes tied. But I think the future you never really know what the future holds for you, and some women may get into another relationship or just decide that they want another child. And so one of the great advantages of the robotic surgery is the fact that you can use sutures which are about the diameter of the human hair, and see them so well through the camera that you can actually put the fallopian tubes, which are incredibly narrow and thin, back together again.
Wow.
And that's
amazing.
Yeah, and that's sort of an alternative to in vitro fertilization.
And on to Sandra, I think. Sandra, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good.
Hi, Dr. Montalto. I have a question about the HPV virus. It seems like you've been hearing a lot about it lately, and they have the immunization that you can give to young adults and teenagers. But if you did not get the vaccination, you're diagnosed with HPV, what is your chances of actually? Is it a very high percentage? Do they know? Have they done any studies on whether you will develop cervical or uterine cancer?
Right. So you have a very low chance of developing cervical cancer if you have the HPV virus. It's actually normal for most women and men, for that matter, to acquire the human papillomavirus or HPV virus over the course of their lifetime.
Somebody told me once it was almost 100%.
It's pretty close. But the majority of women and men will clear the virus over the course of a couple of years.
Really? So you can get rid of it?
You typically do get rid of it.
Interesting.
And you typically don't get reinfected. And so there are a lot of strains of the HPV virus. There are what they call low risk and high risk. And the high risk ones are the ones that lead to cervical cancer. So you can avoid cervical cancer pretty much by routine follow-up with your primary care physician or your OBGYN and occasional testing.
And how can
so
you tell?
So you don't have to get a more frequent than a once a year pap smear.
No.
That's sufficient.
I think we're starting to learn that that's too much.
Oh, okay then.
And so how can you tell whether you've got the HPV virus?
Typically, it's we don't test women under 21. Mm-hmm. Okay. In fact, even through their 20s, we just assume that they have the HPV
virus.
And so, what's important is to start testing women when they're over 30. Those are typically the women who may not clear the high risk strains of the HPV virus.
Okay. Hey, Sandra, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
It's very helpful. Appreciate it. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and I mean short. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Middletown Medical, now offering evening walk-in urgent care for children every weeknight until 9, plus evening sports physicals, 845-342-4774. Furniture options, Goshen, specializing in the stressless functional reclining chair, engineered for head, lumbar, and body weight support, fernops.com. And St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery, choose stmarys.com.
Oh, we're here. Thank you, Zachary. Appreciate that. And we are here with Dr. Nicholas Montalto, and he is giving us a very good show today in terms of things that we might not have known, and I certainly don't know. That's really great. Okay, we'll go to Tina in Kingston. Okay, Tina, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm 56, and I'm going through menopause, and I'm having a really hard time. I sweat, and I'm on fire. I feel like I'm literally on fire when this happens. I know it only lasts for like seconds, and my heart races. What's up with that?
Don't
laugh.
Is it occurring mostly during the day or at night?
No, this is happening at night for me.
Yeah, the night sweats. So, you know, we had sort of mentioned this before. The thing that's happening is that your ovaries are running out of eggs. And so the hormone level in the ovaries and therefore in the body is decreasing. And so what happens as that estrogen level drops is, and nobody knows exactly the reason, but you will start to have these hot flashes and night sweats. And, you know, if you don't do anything, they will typically resolve, although there's a small portion of women that continue to have them through their life.
Right,
I know. Right. So you know, you can talk to your provider about treatments, and the most common treatment, the most effective treatment is actually small doses of hormones.
But I'm so afraid of that.
Right. And most women are, because of that study that came out in 2001, the Women's Health Initiative, that said that hormones, that estrogen and progesterone cause breast cancer. But we've learned a lot of things since those studies. And the big things that we've learned is that we can use much lower doses of hormones than we were using before for much shorter periods of time. And the way you actually get the hormones has changed a little bit, too. Instead of taking the pill by mouth, you can take incredibly small doses of hormones in a patch form across the skin, which are incredibly safe. And though I don't think any studies will be done again on hormones, I'm very comfortable in prescribing those for patients for the shortest period of time, which is typically only a couple of years. And I think that your chances of things like breast cancer and uterine cancer are incredibly small if you do it that way.
I'm a very healthy person. But I feel like I'm losing my mind. I am so emotional lately that it's like, oh, my God. I just came from the doctor's because I'm out of my mind.
Right.
They have me on a monitor because they want to check my heart because it's going out of control.
Right. And actually, what's really interesting about what you said.
I don't know.
Hold on, Tina.
I wish you was here next to me.
Tina, hold on a second. Go ahead.
What's really interesting about what you said is that typically all the emotional ups and downs that women have as a result of menopause or the transition to menopause is from not sleeping at night.
I have sleep apnea too.
Yeah, if you can solve the problem of sleeping at night, oftentimes a lot of the emotional ups and downs will go away.
That's the answer. I don't sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tina.
Yes.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
A whole bunch of people behind you. We appreciate it.
I know. God bless you. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Tina. Bye bye.
Okay. Yeah. Bye.
We'll go to Nancy in Saugerties. Nancy in Saugerties, you're on.
Hi. I was just wondering if having had an ovarian cyst that has dissolved increases your risk for more cysts or ovarian cancer.
It doesn't increase your chances of ovarian cancer. It's actually a very interesting question because, as we talked about the menstrual cycle, as an egg develops every month and it is sort of primed to be released, it comes along with a cyst. The cyst is what houses the egg. And so cysts are common in a woman's cycle. Every single month, every woman has a cyst. And that cyst typically resolves at the end of the month if you do or do not get pregnant. So really, just following with ultrasounds to make sure that the cyst resolves is all you need to do.
But just to get this straight, if does every cyst have to have an egg?
No, and there can be multiple different types of cysts, right? But a cyst that sort of comes over the course of a cycle and then goes away mm-hmm. is typically the one that's associated with egg development.
Uh-huh. Okay, Nancy, now, anything else?
Well, what if it was a cyst that was after menopause?
If it's a cyst after menopause, then the key thing to do is to follow it with ultrasound. And if it is a cyst that's what they call complex, and your doctor will sort of look at those markers, then a persistent cyst after menopause has to be removed.
Because?
Dissolves, so it's okay that it's dissolved. It doesn't need follow-up.
That's perfect. If they followed it with ultrasound and it went away on its own, then it was obviously a benign cyst. Those that are persistent have the possibility of malignancy or cancer, so they need to be removed.
Well, it dissolved, it was followed, and it dissolved, and so I guess everything is fine. Thank you so much.
You're good, Nancy. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay, and we'll go to Kim in Northampton. Kim, you're on.
Yes, hi. Hi, doctor. Hi, Alan. I got a two-part question. In 2000, I was 40, and I had a full hysterectomy. And the reason for it was I was told after ultrasounds, and I think it was called a CA-124, is that right, the blood test?
125, yep.
125, that I had lots of tumors, and I was having incredible heavy flow and was painful. And the two times that they did the CA-125, the results were, as quote-unquote the doctor said, off the chart, indicating a likelihood of cancer. Said, however, we won't know until we get in there. And based on that, based on the pain that I'd been through, I said, full hysterectomy, that's fine. And he did not, you know, counsel me towards anything less than that. So I did that. And then when I came to, he says, good news, none of the fibroid tumors were cancerous. So now here I am 13 years out. I've not done any hormone therapy. I have osteoporosis from my hips down. I'm 53, and osteopenia for the rest. And I'm doing the calcium, doing the vitamin D. I'm doing fish oil. I'm doing Avoca for my joints and stuff like that. But my primary doctor, and I always bring it up, you know, is there any connection between having had that hysterectomy and what's going on with me with the osteoarthritis? And they never really seem to address it. And, you know, so I'm thinking, well, you know, there is osteoarthritis genetically in my family, so should I not be worried about that? And so that's the one question is what, you know, 13 years out after having had a full hysterectomy, should I be asking my doctor about my health? And then what's up with the false positives on that blood test?
Right. So how old were you when you had the hysterectomy?
40.
You were 40. So yeah. The CA125 it stands for cancer antigen 125, and it's the tumor marker we were speaking about earlier in terms of trying to predict ovarian cancer. So
yeah.
The unfortunate part, what's difficult about that is that there are a lot of other conditions that raise your CA125 level that are not cancer. And that can be endometriosis, or typically any ovarian masses that irritate the lining inside your body will raise your CA125. Okay. Now, unfortunately, you don't know what's raising your CA125 until you actually do the surgery. Fibroids, though, don't have anything to do with CA125. Mm-hmm. So it must have been something going on with the ovaries that sort
right.
of, you know, stimulated them to do the surgery.
Right.
In terms of you know, sort of let's say through your 40s, you know, estrogen was important for you through your 40s.
Mm-hmm.
It is important for bone health. But what we know now also, though, is that we have excellent treatments for osteoporosis, which is probably what you should be working on with your physician now.
What are some of those, doctor?
So there is a class called bisphosphonates, which mm-hmm. which are actually will sort of decrease the resorption and increase some amount of bone.
What are the common names for that?
Fosamax is one of them. Yeah,
yeah,
that's probably one of the most common. So doing the calcium is important. Doing vitamin D is important, and weight bearing exercise to keep the strength mm-hmm. of your bones. So, and that's sort of not necessarily osteoarthritis. That's more osteoporosis and osteopenia. Mm-hmm. But that's the direction I would go in now for you.
Hasn't there been some adverse literature on Fosamax?
There has, yeah. But by and large, it's a pretty safe medication, and they're actually mm-hmm. starting to change the way they deliver those medications also. So
interesting.
Instead of taking them by mouth, by IV now.
Interesting. Kim, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Yep, thank you.
Yep. Okay, we may have time for one or two more here. We have time for two, maybe a third if somebody wants to call. Okay, we'll go to Emily in Rhinebeck, 1-800-348-2551. Go, Emily.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just calling. I'm 32. I have a history of PCOS. I'm on the thin side of PCOS. And I was just wondering if there was any new research about diet-based therapy if you don't have overt evidence of insulin resistance. I had gestational diabetes when I was pregnant, but I've had my insulin levels checked while not pregnant, and they've been fine. I was just looking for a way to control or possibly, you know, improve that condition.
Right. Is there a family history of diabetes also?
No family history of diabetes, no.
Yeah. So I think, so polycystic ovaries, or PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, is a condition where there is, by ultrasound, multiple cysts within the ovary, and then some metabolic conditions. And those metabolic conditions are typically insulin resistance. So insulin that's released by the body as you eat isn't really utilized very well. And often hypertension goes along with that also. The lifetime risks if you have the polycystic ovarian syndrome is diabetes, hypertension, and endometrial cancer. So you are one of the minorities, though, of polycystic ovarian patients because you're not obese, and that's typically what we see. So I think if you maintain a healthy diet, sort of the low carbohydrate, more higher protein, higher fat diet, you're going to protect yourself against the insulin resistance and diabetes.
Okay, so very quickly then, Dr. PCOS, one more time, is?
Is polycystic ovarian syndrome. So
okay.
It's a condition of your body is resistant to insulin.
Yeah.
You actually have too much male hormone, too much androgen.
Interesting.
And it can lead to things like infertility is the big thing it leads to for women of reproductive age.
Emily, I thank you for your call. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go to Don in Great Barrington. Don?
Good afternoon, Doctor. Thank you, and Happy New Year to all of us. Since we're all normally born with two gonads, I wonder if a woman sacrifices one, is she still more or less able to conceive?
Yes, absolutely. As long as she has a functioning ovary and a functioning fallopian tube to pick up the egg, she can get pregnant.
Is the chance reduced by having just one?
Chance is reduced.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don. Let's go to Robin in Pittsfield. Robin.
Oh, hi, doctor. Thank you for taking my call. My question is in reference to my daughter. She's 23 years old, but when she was very young, she was diagnosed with that polycystic ovarian that you were just talking about. But more recently, she still has very painful periods and a lot of weight gain. She has no other symptoms of polycystic ovarian, and they're not doing anything for her. I mean, they put her on a low dose of birth control, but they told her she can't have children ever. So I don't.
Right. So that's they may tell her that that there's an increased chance of infertility, and the big problem with polycystic ovaries is that you don't ovulate every month. And if you're not ovulating, then pregnancy is going to be difficult. But there are excellent medications out there. The most common one is a medication called Clomid, which induces ovulation in women that have polycystic ovaries. And actually, the low-dose birth control pill that she's on is the perfect treatment for her right now until she's ready to have babies.
And is it normal to have all – she has, like, a lot of cysts. She has a lot of cysts.
Yes, that's kind of where the definition comes. If you look at the ovary on ultrasound, there'll be what they call a string of pearls, which is multiple cysts around the periphery of the ovary, and that's where the name of the disease comes from.
And do we know where it comes from? How are we going to get it?
Typically genetic.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, really? And now, how about the weight gain? Is there any relation between the two?
There is. The weight gain is typically from the insulin resistance, and so the key is it is difficult for women with polycystic ovaries to lose weight, but in conjunction with their primary care physician, it's getting on almost a diet like a diabetic would be on.
Yeah, she's very, very strict. How about that drug metformin I've heard of?
Metformin can be good in order to that's going to be used more for infertility. So if she's not able to ovulate and the medication Clomid hasn't worked, then sometimes they can add metformin, which is to treat the insulin resistance.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
So the good news there, if I wish she had stayed on, but the good news there is, if the daughter had said she'd never have babies, you think that there's a chance she will have babies.
There's an excellent chance she'll have babies. Yeah, it's probably one of the easiest conditions to treat because we know exactly what causes it and what medications to give.
Well, interesting. Okay, let's go to Andy in Albany. Andy in Albany, you got a good question. Go ahead.
Yes, good day, doctor. I have a question regarding the herpes.
Yes.
Unfortunately, over a decade ago, I contracted the herpes, and I was told by my doctor that I should take Valtrex. And now I take a generic Valtrex called acyclovir, I believe it's pronounced.
Right.
And so I take it daily, whether it's a breakout or not, and I haven't had a breakout in years. However, when my wife and I have relations, I still use a condom. Is that necessary?
It is probably a good idea. They're not 100% effective in preventing transmission of the virus, but it's the best thing we have. The problem is asymptomatic, so you don't have a herpes lesion, let's say, or a blister, but you still can be shedding virus, and that's not going to be possible for you to know when that time is. So
have we made any improvements in how to handle this thing?
I don't think so. I mean, there's no vaccine for it. So I don't think there's anything more you can do, but sort of avoid contact when you know you have an active lesion, and then to treat with the acyclovir.
Andy, anything else on that?
No, but it's okay to take it daily, even if I don't have a breakout?
Yes. In fact, it's a good idea because that may prevent the breakout.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you, doctor.
You're Thanks, welcome. Andy. Okay. We have a couple of minutes, doctor. If anybody wants to get in touch with you guys and wants to know more about the robotic surgery program, how would they do it?
So they can contact me through Ellis Medical Group at Ellis Medicine, and I think all of my contact information would be on our website.
Is that ellismedicine.com? Org?
Yep, yeah. ellismedicine.org.
And Ellis has two L's in it?
Two L's, you got
okay.
it.
Okay. And number one. And number two, what do you find is the most common complaint you get?
I'd say the most common complaint I get is going to be the abnormal uterine bleeding. So women who are bothered by their menstruation, either it's too heavy and they can't get to work every day, or they can't go to school, or they can't do the normal functioning that they want to, seek some type of definitive treatment. And that's typically after some type of conservative treatment like medication has failed.
Well, I have to say, it has been, Dr. Nicholas Montalto, it has been a pleasure to have you and to host you here today. You are a very bright guy, and you certainly know your stuff, and it's great to have you. So we're out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in. I'd also like to thank our guest, Dr. Nicholas Montalto from the Ellis Group, for joining me today. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the incomparable Zach Malloy. He's wearing his taxicab driver hat, and we love him. Your calls were answered by Pauline Clark, and she did a terrific job. Tom Jobe handled our social media. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall, the woman who never rests. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.